Welcome to question time. Yeah. I couldn't help that. We'll begin our second day. Hajj Abdul Samad, same format as yesterday, and Hajj Abdul Samad is going to give two talks, two different aspects of zakat, which is something that, very closely we talk a lot about the zakat, and at some stage it means less talk and more action, so hopefully this will be part of that. So,
this one. Assalamu alaikum. A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wa la hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyyil azim. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. We made headlines and then I haven't really kept to it, so this it doesn't really work out as I planned it at all. We had a, with Hajj Abdul Haq's wonderful discourse last night, we had a lead-in to today's, which, because Hajj Abdul Haq said, confirmed again at the end of his discourse that the beginning of the whole affair is the Sharia, and abiding by the Sharia and following the Sunnah. And when we were first Muslims, we always said, yes, 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 we'll do that, right, let's get on with it. So the surprise for us was that the discovery that we not only had to abide by the Sharia and the Sunnah, but we had to bring it into existence where it didn't exist, in our own lives and in our societies, and even in the Muslim societies, in fact, where it doesn't, it's fallen into disuse. And more surprising was, in fact, that we had to find the knowledge of the Sharia and the Sunnah, that it had been obliterated, that knowledge had been obliterated by a couple of movements. The first movement was the modernist movement, really, which tried to equate Islam in every way with the modern technological state, and really say that Islam was really just bringing us to a welfare society, a secular, modern, democratic state. And then the other movement that we were all plagued with was the one that looked more outwardly Islamic, where people grew beards and they could tell you all the hadith, that in fact the beard should be four fingers in length, and that you had to roll up your trousers when you came to the prayer. And somehow that was what their Islam amounted to. So this was something for which we owe an incredible debt of gratitude to Sheikh Abdul Qadir, because he rediscovered a very clear and pure Islamic fiqh, the fiqh of the people of Medina, about which there isn't any argument, as the more we have seen the book that Hajj Abdul Haq and Aisha translated from Sheikh Ibn Taymiyyah, where he absolutely affirms that this is the purest source about which nobody can disagree. So we owe a lot to Sheikh Al-Qadir for having found that. And I could just add a personal note that when we were first living in Scotland, the first year or two, Sheikh Al-Qadir regarded that he had gone to Scotland to retire. And he said to us, I've done my bit. I found you the right Aqidah. Because all of this we're talking about is under the Aqidah. He said, it's now up to you. You've got to do it. And he said this a number of times in the first year that we were there. And then Sheikh Al-Qadir really rediscovered the Ottomans and all of these things that happened with Turkey and all of the events that happened after that. And he gave up any thought of retiring to Scotland, basically. So, but I think it still stands that Sheikh Al-Qadir found out all of this and it's up to us to do it. So the fiqh of Medina, which Sheikh Al-Qadir found, is very kind of clear and dynamic. If one reads the work of the ulama and the fuqaha, this fiqh is very striking in comparison with the other madhabs, in a way that it not to say that there's not good in all the madhabs and that all of them are serviceable having got this one, just to describe its qualities, the qualities of the fiqh of Medina, is it's very, very direct and clear, and it cuts through very quickly to a judgment. And it's a living tradition which has come right down to our time. Sheikh Muhammad ibn al-Habib radiallahu anhu was a living faqih, thoroughly trained in the fiqh of the Maliki Madhab. He was alive, is alive in Morocco and other places. There are qadis who pass judgment by it. There's a tradition which is more than is almost a millennium and a half long of meeting new situations and arriving at judgments and then embodying that in the amal. So it's something very dynamic that's very equipped for us to then look at our situation and make the decisions that we need to make. So we had to, connecting it back to Hajj al-Haq's discourse, the seeker of this experience that he talked about, and this knowledge, then has to abide by the Sharia and the Sunnah, but has to, in our case, actually recreate it, and has to re-find the knowledge, the pure knowledge by which he will recreate it. But added to that, then we come into Islam because we've all, almost all of us, said the Shahada from having come from Christian background. So we come into Islam and we find ourselves immediately in a situation where there is a war between Islam and kufr. You could say that very clearly kufr is on a very powerful assault upon Islam. So all adds to the situation that we face. So speaking personally, when I came from Dublin to the conference that Hajj al-Halim organized on usury here in Norwich years ago, the conference which was called Usury, Root Cause of the Injustices of Our Time, or the Major Injustices of Our Time, I remember it was a very strong experience for me because I realized that this was the issue, a key issue in this war. This is a key issue that we've put our finger on a matter that's absolutely central to what's going on. And I'd like to just say that when we come to the issue of zakat, we come to one of the battles in that war which has the scent of victory in it. It has the scent of victory. So there are a few, I want to preface it, because what I intended to do, as yesterday, is to go through Qadi Iyad's Foundations of Islam on the Zakat, to know that material. While doing it, I had a look again at Hajj al-Haq's book on Zakat, which is a wonderful, concise and carefully digested study of the Zakat, where Hajj al-Haq he's made it kind of palatable and easily understood, all of this material. So it's very, this is one of our key works in this matter. But before going on to the foundations of Islam, I'd like to preface a few things. I mentioned the sense that now this is a matter in which there is victory, there is a great victory waiting for us. And I wanted to put it in the context of the situation of the Muslims across the planet, because as I see it, the situation of the Muslims changed utterly. And I remember we were talking in the mosque the other night about the Juma prayer in Morocco, for example. And I know when I was in Morocco in the 70s, there were these wonderful huge mosques and a few lines of old men for the Juma. But Hajj al-Haq was mentioning that now, if you don't get there early, you pray in the street. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of people going to the Jummah. The Daily Telegraph had a two-day spread on Islam to mark the 11th of September. And they sent a very kind of average Anglican Christian reporter to Damascus, Beirut, and Cairo to report on the temper of the Muslims in these lands. And it was very moving. It was three-page spreads from the Telegraph. It was very, very moving to read, because apart from the absolute consensus among the people that the Americans are totally out of hand and that they're totally dominated by the Jews, it was absolutely clear there was nobody at all discreet about it. But everybody in the Middle East was saying Islam. They were saying Allah. They were saying the Book of Allah, the Sunnah of the Messenger. Everybody, almost everybody without exception. And the mosques were packed. The mosques for the Juma were packed. So this is something that out of these very unpleasant circumstances that happened recently, this extraordinary thing has happened, that the more and more of the Muslims are waking up and they're doing the prayer. And Sheikh al-Qadr, in a discourse in Slough once, he said to the... Because the immigrant Muslims have always said, we're these bad, bad people. We came here for the dunya, and, you know, you're much better than us. We're so bad. And Sheikh al-Qadr said, you thought you came here for the dunya, but Allah brought you here to establish Islam. And he said, look, what you did was you said you've got to do the prayer. Yeah, people, the Muslims said, we've got to do the prayer. We're Muslims, we've got to do it together. We've got to have a place where we can do the jamaat. We've got to have mosques. We've got to have halal food. And they did all of these things without a priesthood or a church or a state directing the affair. And he said, this is the power of the Muslims. And he said, once the Muslims grasp the nature of the dinar, there's going to be no stopping it. There will be no stopping it, because the ordinary Muslim will say, I refuse anything else. I will pay my zakat and the dinar. I don't want to be paid in this paper money. So this, once everybody has taken on the prayer, it's not that far before people begin to discover these things that we've been talking about in these small gatherings. And the age, there was an age where people talked to Islamic banks, and there was a kind of a sheikh to Islamic economics. But basically, it's disappointed everybody, and people have become much more sophisticated. People are saying all over the Muslim world, the Islamic bank is not it. It's not acceptable. So there's a new age happening, and we're saying the right thing at the right time. And we even had documents a couple of years ago from Western economists, and they had actually, this was at a time when we were just saying the dinar, Omar Vadio was just saying the dinar and just saying that it had to be paid in this, used in the zakat. And these Western economists picked up that and thought that we were a much more substantial body than we were. They basically put together the fact of the dinar and the Muslims being a quarter of humanity, and they said, we're in deep trouble. They said, this thing, if the Muslims take this on, this will utterly transform the nature of the economic system of the world and basically put an end to banking. So we have those documents, we have those articles by these people. And I think a part of it is that there's going to be a whole transformation in the leadership of the Muslims, because again, that whole fashion of the people who spoke about the Islamic economics, they're going to disappear. People, there's a whole generation of young Muslims who are no longer content with all of that. And I suggest that this new leadership, we've talked about Amirate, and for a lot of people, Amirate is kind of a question. Well, then what? What does he do? What is the? It's somehow they don't really fully get it. You know, okay, I pledge allegiance, but then what? And I think somehow it's already been said to us that there's another way to look at it, because from out of the pillars of the deen, from out of the pillar of the prayer, you have to have an imam. Once you're doing the prayer, you see it's quite natural in any body of people that an imam emerges. And once you recognize the zakat, you've got to have an amir. That has to happen. So I think that the people who take on the zakat are going to become the new leadership, the people who do this. And they're basically going to authorize the collectors and the distributors, and the zakat will kind of pass into their hands and out of their hands, and it won't stay in their hands. So these new leaders are going to be like the catalyst in a chemical experiment that makes the reaction, makes the reaction happen, but isn't changed itself in any way. This is going to be the nature of the Amir in that process. He will make this thing happen, but he will not be changed. Because, of course, there have been unjust Amirs. We will meet all of this in the fiqh. There have been unjust Amirs who have made themselves wealthy, which is a trivial thing, or there have been emirs who have then, for various purposes, diverted funds to inappropriate places. For example, you may not use zakat for a mosque. It may not be used for a mosque. Yeah? So there's all of that, but I'm saying that the emir will be like a catalyst in this, and that's what will make him, that is actually what will make people emirs in the local communities, is the fact that they do catalyze this thing, and they will be recognized and validated by the fact that this is done in a trustworthy manner. And I was thinking of our place, because we're still a tiny body, we're still a small group that are saying this thing. And what is the place of this small body of Murabitun in this? And there's a thing from an observation that was made years ago. It's actually from a man called Rupert Sheldrake, who proposed a scientific theory which he called morphogenetic fields. So he's rather peripheral, but it was based on some actual observations which were puzzling to people, which was when they introduced milk deliveries with bottles with gold and silver tops to indicate the cream in the milk. And these little birds called the tit used to come and alight on the bottle and peck through it and drink the cream. Yeah? And now apparently if you've got homogenized milk, they don't bother anymore. So this happened very quickly all over the country. And it puzzled the scientists a great deal, because their thinking in this is, how did the tit learn to do it? And then how did all of the tits learn to do it? What was the process? Was there some tit going around saying, come over here, peck this bottle? It was a puzzle to them, and they worked very hard on it. And there weren't, in fact, any good explanations. The Darwinian theory would be that some particular tits were genetically different, so that they were the ones who did this, and that they would then be they would have this gene which they would transmit to their posterity, which would give them a selective advantage and over generations, right? This is Darwinian, but obviously this is not the case, because this happened like lightning across England. So this man proposed a theory which he called the morphogenetic field, was that a species has like a field which is something like an electromagnetic field, such that when someone within the species learns the thing, when one of these birds learns the thing, it somehow quite quickly becomes a part of the field, so that all the birds learn it. Huh? Which is whether or not it's true or not, but you do see it happening. Huh? You see that when we begin to say things, then you find people saying it. Shilkara said the Muslim village, and people started to talk about Muslim villages and even build one in America. There were many things like that. So the very fact that we're already in this tiny little gathering talking about it again is possibly it's part of this morphogenetic field of the Muslims. It's going to happen everywhere, inshallah, very quickly. And I wanted just to to put it in the perspective of our traditional understanding of fiqh and ilm, because I wanted to dismiss one idea, which is the idea that there are ulama, and there are fuqaha, and then there's Muslims. And this is really not acceptable as a view, because the view is much more pragmatic in that you need knowledge to worship Allah and to do what is needed to be done, to avoid what is haram and to do what's obligatory. Therefore, it's obligatory in everybody. Knowledge is obligatory in everybody. And and fiqh is obligatory on you. You've got to, the moment you say the shahada, I mean, before you say the shahada, you need to understand tawheed, because that is what you're affirming. But when you've said the shahada, you've got to know the fiqh of the prayer as much as you need in order to do the prayer. So, for example, when people come to us to say the shahada, it's incumbent upon us to know that they're equipped to do the prayer before we ask them to say the shahada. Within kind of reasonable bounds, there's judgments that have to be made in different cases. People who are passing by, and there's a possibility we may never see them again, and there's all things to weigh up. But by and large, anything you do in the life, you've got to know the fiqh of it. And then within that, there are of course super talented people who have an easy grasp of the material. And then you say, people used to say about people who say, he is an alim. Yeah? I knew people there was a Sudanese man we met who was studying in Umm al-Qura in Mecca. And among the students, they used to say about him, he is an alim. He knows. Huh? But it was in that sense, not in the sense of there being of an elite body of the ulama, which is very often, particularly in the Middle East, how it's presented to us. But specifically in this Maliki tradition, it's more a matter of a populace who have a grasp of fiqh, and among them people who have a better grasp of it. And specifically, as a specific example, it's still something we lack in, is our going into the world. Once you go into the world to earn this thing called money, you're required to know the fiqh of it. We all fall short in that, but this is something we have to get a grasp on. What is halal for us and what is not halal for us in earning a livelihood. Now, also just to append to that, I had occasion to look at the Muwatta recently for something else, and I glanced at the chapter or the book on seeking knowledge. But the book on seeking knowledge in the Muwatta is one single tradition. And that was from an oral transmission from Imam Malik himself, without a narrator, saying that he had heard of the advice of Luqman alayhi salam to his son, this fragment of advice. And Luqman said, "My son, sit with the learned men and keep close to them. Allah gives life to the dead earth with the abundant rain of the sky." Huh? Therefore, the key of it all is keeping good company. As we have seen yesterday, the benefits of keeping company. One of the knowledgeable people, somebody came to ask him a question. He said, "Go away and learn how to ask a question. Then come back." Now, to some extent, we largely regard ourselves as poor people. We don't have a great deal of gold and silver. We do not have cattle. We don't have crops. We don't have mines. So, is there a use in us knowing this material, going through it in depth? One of the things is actually, if we think about it, is that we're not all entirely penniless all the time. It's not actually the case with us. We have funds do come to us, and we have to know how it is, if we are due the zakat on it, and how much, and all of that. So, to some extent, it's not entirely a hypothetical knowledge. But the other aspect is that the people of knowledge say that the first knowledge you must acquire is what's obligatory for you to know, and those things which are haram, and those things which are obligatory for you personally. But the second knowledge then, which is praiseworthy for anybody to acquire, is the knowledge which is obligatory on the whole community. Yeah? There have to be gradations in, you know, you use fiqh even in your approach to acquiring the knowledge of fiqh. The first knowledge is the knowledge of the obligatory, and the second is the knowledge of what's obligatory for everybody. Yeah? Because if we don't know it as a community, if it's not present among us as a community, then we're all in serious trouble. So partly, this is what we're doing. And it is from such an ambience of us learning this material that zakat collectors can emerge. And actually, I think the zakat collector is a kind of a significant figure in, if you want to, you know, if there's points of stress where we have to lay emphasis to make this thing happen, the gold coin being one, and a place where the coin can be spent being another. These are things that will, if we put effort into them, the whole thing may be able to happen. Then the figure of the zakat collector is a very, very significant one. Somebody who knows the fiqh, because he can't be a tax collector. The zakat collector cannot be a tax collector because he has to go to the Muslims with adab and respect. Eh? It's impermissible for him to go to the Muslims as the employee of a state with arrogance and, you know, to take the zakat. He has to go to them with respect and with honor, and he has to have the fiqh to hand to answer the questions, or he has to have access to the fuqaha so that he can find out the problems he doesn't know the answer to himself. And when he's done that, as we'll see in the fiqh, he or the emir have to make a dua for the person who's paid the zakat. So there's a whole adab involved in the zakat collector. And I feel that the zakat collector is one of the key points that will make this whole thing move if we begin to create an ambience from which we can train zakat collectors. Now, the first key thing about the issue of zakat is that we have to know that it's an act of ibadah. One of the ways in which it was subverted was to suggest by the modernists that it was only an act of social welfare, and that Islam presaged the modern secular welfare state, which came about really in the 19th and early 20th century, that somehow Islam was before that, and we already had this. And therefore to say that it's merely a utilitarian and a practical thing of looking after the poor. Huh? So the key understanding that we have to press on heavily here is that this is an act of ibadah like the prayer. And which, as you know, Allah Ta'ala pairs with the prayer. So he says, "Aqimu salata wa atu zakat," innumerable times. I'm not sure how many times it is, but it's something like 50 times in the Quran. Almost, the prayer is almost never mentioned by itself. So why is that? Yeah? Because if it is ibadah, everybody agrees, you may not alter an ibadah. You may not alter it. It must be done in the way that it was done, unless there's a clear argument in the fiqh. And this is the reason why the dinar is absolutely essential, the dinar and the dirham, because there is no, absolutely no basis at all for using anything else. The textual statements from the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the practice among the Khulafa Rashidun and all of the Muslims until basically yesterday was to collect the zakat in gold and silver. They had these little coins called flus in Medina in the time of Imam Malik. They were well known, they were permissible, they were for using, for buying vegetables and the little everyday things. And it was understood that you did not pay zakat on the flus itself, except for traders, who the traders who dealt in the ordinary flow of those everyday types of things. Yeah? And they had to estimate their flus and pay the zakat on it. But you definitely could not pay zakat with flus. And now, flus in Arabic today means money, only means money. They use it in the ordinary sense of money. So the zakat being worship then means that we've got to get back to the fiqh. It's absolutely clear, and the amir is fundamental to it, the zakat collector, and all of these other elements that we're going to study. Because to do anything else would be to say that you could do wudu with milk or wine, or you could add extra prostrations to the prayer. And what is interesting, in some ways, we should stop beating the Salafis, you see, and we should say, we should just get this thought to them. Because if the Salafis, by their doctrine of being Salafis, then they have to be absolutely fanatical about this. They ought to be fanatical about the dinar and the dirham. And if they understood it, they are sincere people, they're honest people, they would be. So maybe we should get this thought in among them. So again, the elements, the emir, that the zakat is paid in the locality, it is not sent abroad. It's not sent abroad. It's very clear. Except in the case where everybody in the locality has been looked after and there's severe need in people in another city or another land. Then the emir may choose to give some of the zakat out of the locality. One of the things just to note in passing is that sadaqah is the other term for zakat. We use the term zakat for the obligatory zakat and sadaqah for voluntary giving. But in the Quran, in the books of fiqh, sadaqah is used interchangeably with zakat. So, and this has an interest because sadaqah comes from a root meaning to tell the truth. So it's an indication that the slave in his dua and his dhikr and his ibadah is truthful. The zakat is a confirmation of the truthfulness of the slave. And as the prayer has a wudu, without which the prayer is not valid, without purifying oneself after going to the toilet, without performing wudu, there is in fact a wudu for the zakat, if you like to say that, as a form of purification, because it is well known of the 40 hadith of Imam An-Nawawi, rahimahullah, that Allah is pure and He only accepts what is pure. And that is understood to mean that you cannot give sadaqah, you cannot give zakat from wealth that is not pure. So fundamental to the zakat is the purification of our wealth, the purification of all of our monetary and financial and business transactions. And this is something, this is one of the reasons I said we're on the scent of victory here, because when the Muslims take this seriously, then they will abolish banking and these types of transactions from their lives. And this will be an end of it. we're in this zone, we come up against this matter of economics. And when economics was introduced into the university system in England, the academics were outraged, and they said this is a pseudoscience, it's not an authentic science. And this is in fact still the case, it is not a genuine science. A genuine science can predict accurately that if you do this, this and this, such and such will happen. There's no discernible pattern in economics in that sense. And economics, in fact, is the study of the flows of money when usury enters into a situation. So do not be awed by economists. One of the matters, again, excuse me kind of jumping in these subjects, but just to approach it properly, to locate everything properly, we need to touch on a number of different matters. And this matter of money, there's the quote that Rais Omar Video found, which from Imam Malik, which was that any commodity that the people accept is money, in fact. Because when you go through the Muwatta, if you read it, it's very challenging to the intellect to read the Muwatta, and it's very important to have read through it carefully as a record of the Salaf, you see, as the record of the transactions of the Salaf. And you actually see that a lot of the transactions of people were in fact barter. A lot of transactions were barter, and that in fact what we would regard as a purchase or a monetary transaction was a barter. You see, all transactions are actually types of barter, because gold and silver are themselves worth something. So in the transaction you say, do I want to exchange? Both people say, do I want to exchange these two for each other? There's something in that. There's not the abstract idea of money that we've got at all. And it's a matter of reflection, but you see that with gold and silver in transactions, that people, when you enter into a transaction, the danger would be meanness and miserliness, because there's a natural desire to hold on to the gold and the silver, because it's something in itself valuable. And therefore, there will be a conservative element in Muslims using gold and silver, that they will hold on to the gold and silver and maybe not purchase. And the opposite happens with paper money, because everybody knows, experiences existentially, that when you work for a living, and then at the end of having given your life, because you give your life in this thing called a job or whatever, in one's working, at the end of it to receive bits of paper, people know existentially that that is not a just reward for having given one's time and one's life and one's effort. But the other extreme of that is that the person then goes into the market and has the opposite transaction, because you have these bits of paper which you know existentially are nonsense, and then you get rid of them as quickly as you can. So you see the kind of feverish way that people shop, which was never known before, this type of shopping, that people just go out with a pocket full of money and shop. It didn't happen before. The supermarket is absolutely brand new. The supermarket is not actually halal, you see. It's not a halal form. The form of trading has to be that there's a person between you and the items for sale. And you meet the person and he says, what would you like? And you say, I'd like that packet of soap. And he gives you the packet of soap. So people used to go into the world with a list of what they needed, meet a person, get the thing, and apart from everyday items, then there would be some kind of negotiation of what the value of the thing was to both parties. But to open a supermarket and to lay everything out in the open is not a halal transaction, because it encourages people to steal. Somebody who encourages somebody to steal is an equal party, equally guilty with the thief. And it is not actually theft to steal from a supermarket. It is not theft. The emir could not cut the hand. He could not cut the hand. Because for it to be theft, it has to clearly be put in a place where it is inaccessible, and it's known that this is somebody's property. If you lay it out like that, you haven't done that. And you allow people to go and pick it. So a qadi could not cut the hand of somebody who stole from a supermarket. But if the man breaks into the supermarket at night and steals from it, the qadi will cut the hand. So all of these things, it's a science that's been lost, but we have to remember. So one of the things about money is that it can be a commodity. It can be anything that people accept, not something that's symbolic, except in the case of flus. There is actually a case for making small units of flus, even from paper. It's a possibility. But then the thing that matters about money, all that matters about money, is that it should be able to go around in a circle without being stopped and then on the way. And a part of that is, in fact, the emir taking it as zakat. Because once it's taken as zakat and given to the miskeen, even if we had not got a food cooperative in place, for example, it is still possible in a society where that happens that the miskeen can go to a trader and say, the emir accepts these as zakat. If you will allow me to purchase from you with this coin, the emir will accept it as zakat. So that allows it to go around in a circle. So there were people have known about paper money in this society, not non-Muslims, for a long time. And there's people who invented currencies, paper currencies, to escape from the banking paper currency. And all the key thing that was needed was that, for example, the mayor of a town would accept the local rates or the local taxes in paper money. That was all that was needed to give a validity to the currency. Of course.
So in a society like that, the same way of trading.
Yes.
Where would the gold and silver actually come in? I mean, if there's a lot of poor people and the services are being traded and bartered.
Yes.
At what point would they start eating gold and silver?
The poor people.
Or just everyday people.
In how do you mean exactly?
Well. Was it used as at a certain point you transform your wealth into gold and silver? I don't quite understand what it was used.
Well, it's because we're in a surreal situation. It's why, because it was always there. So it's more a matter of how do we reintroduce it in a way. Yes.
It occurred naturally in society, so it was seen as a valuable commodity.
Yes.
It started to be used, so it was.
Yes.
Society was a mixture.
Silver was always the currency of the poor people, because a silver coin is basically a pound. It's around about a pound. So it was always the currency for the poor people. In the early generations of Islam, they used the Persian and the Roman coins. They didn't mint coins at all. The Rasul sallallahu alaihi wasallam minted no coins. They used those that were there. And so dinar and dirham, I think, actually come from non-Arabic words, if I remember rightly.
Dinaro.
Yes. So, and then at one point, it's possible that Sayyidina Uthman radiallahu anhu used existing coins and stamped the basmala or something on one side. And then finally, in one of the khulafa, Abdul Malik ibn Marwan, then he issued a whole lot of coins. But the role of the emir in this is not not even necessarily ownership or possession of the coins, but just the coin. You see, why coins have a king's head or a queen's head and on it, is just that they've set up the system of minting, and the stamp says that's a regular coin. I stand by it. Yes, yes. So the coins, the gold and the silver can come from anywhere. Come from. I don't know if this is a. How we get in. Well, I mean, a part of the possibility is the food cooperative, for example.
Yeah, I mean, in our situation, is to want to get physical coins in the locality, if you like, with different ways, and then to set up places that actually use them. So we're setting up the food cooperative, we're accepting the pledges that people make for the mosque in dinars and dirhams. We're encouraging all the people in business to take them, to accept them. So first of all, we're trying to get that in place. Well, not first, but alongside it, get places where it can be spent. So that when you give it to someone as like a, you know, it's not this strange thing, oh, I might as well put this on the shelf. You can actually go and spend it. So we're trying to do that alongside trying to physically get coins here that people can just buy. Even to just start giving them as gifts at the beginning, just to get used to using them, to get people to use the dinar system and so on.
Yeah.
Perhaps would you suggest that you could use peg money at a certain small denominations? Is that permissible?
Well, it's conceivable if we make our own paper money.
Yeah, yeah.
And the as far as I understood, the flus could be as large as half a dirham. So nothing bigger than a 50 pence coin.
At least we start trading them as a service.
That's a 50 pence. But so there'll be smaller units, you know, 10 pence and whatever. Yes. So you might as well use the dirhams. Silver is very cheap now. That's one of the things that's artificially cheap. Artificially cheap. I think
the Zakat book, the Hajjah Black, which Abu Samad mentioned, I mean, it is a small book, but it's the clearest thing we do, yeah. We do have in terms of spelling it out, what's possible,
yes.
Setting out the framework for it.
One thing I think is mistaken to see, you said about the barter issue,
yes.
That those societies that had this sort of natural currency situation, there wasn't so much cash. It wasn't a situation where everything had to be a cash transaction. There was that barter exchange.
Yes. In fact, I mean, at one point, one of these in-flight magazines, you got this statistic once that a fifth of world trade is still in barter. That, you know, people swap Lockheed airplanes for petroleum and all of this stuff. Still a lot of barter, on a very substantial scale. I've come to a natural kind of break. I don't know if the coffee's there, but it would be better to take a break, and then because then I want to go through the material from the Foundations of Islam and that. Take this off now.